I was out of town when it happened. I live in Augusta, Georgia. You may have heard of Augusta, Georgia. I don't know. We're famous because of the fact that we have a golf tournament over there every year. You may have heard of that, called the Masters. It's coming up pretty soon now. That happens once a year, and Alice and the girls and I rent our house out and leave town that week. We don't want to be there for all those tours. You may have heard of us because of the fact there's some famous people from Augusta, Georgia. Some very famous people from Augusta, Georgia. You may have heard of, for you older folks, remember Brenda Lee? Brenda Lee and I went to grammar school together. I was in the first grade. She was in the fifth. She has now, I guess, a country music career. I believe that is correct. Some of you may have heard of James Brown. James Brown. Oh! James Brown. You heard of him? James Brown lives in Augusta, Georgia. I see him occasionally around town. We've had some talks about God in the Bible, actually. I've gone to his house and we visited about God over a period of time. Like every other city, there's some things we're proud of and some things we're not so proud of. I don't know if you saw it on the news or not when it happened. It was some time ago. I was out of town when it happened. As a matter of fact, my first understanding of it was getting back to town, and a medical doctor who is a friend of mine and her husband had been staying at our house with our children while Alice and I had been traveling. And as we returned, she said, "Have you heard the news?" "Well, no," she said, "you could have. It's been on national news." "Well, what is it?" "Well, right here, just outside of Augusta, just across the river into Carolina. A fellow walked into a place here the other day, a place where he had been working for a while, but it's not quite clear if he was fired or quit, but somehow he left there. And he was so full of rage, apparently, he walked back in just yesterday with a pistol, and he had it all planned out very thoroughly, and he shot 7 of them. 4 of them are dead. The other 3 apparently are going to live." And, of course, the reason that was interesting to us was because of the fact that he went to church with us. A very angry man, had been angry for some length of time. As a matter of fact, selfishly, and I begged God to forgive me for the thought as soon as it went through my mind, selfishly, even as bad and evil as that act had been of him killing those people, the first thing I prayed was, "Oh God, thank you that he didn't do it at church." Because his anger came there. As a matter of fact, almost every time I ever saw him at church, I've never ever seen him sit. Except one business meeting he came to where he wanted to talk about how bad I was. Other than that, I'd never seen him sit at church. He would always stand in the back, and it made him mad. He tried to shake his hand, and now he had killed 4 people, tried to kill 3 more, and then he drank poison trying to kill himself, but he wasn't quite so good at that, and he will stand trial next year. You say, why do people do those kinds of things? I mean, particularly somebody who was a Christian, who had been converted to the Lord Jesus Christ, supposedly had a relationship with God. How? How could it be? And, of course, all of us have been riveted for the last few days about that occurred over in Jonesboro. And even again this morning, an elder at the Southwest Church in Jonesboro asked that I ask you to pray for everybody in that area because the aftermath is, as you can imagine, devastating. I understand they're burying Shannon today, Shannon Wright, who would have been here. That was her plan. I guess the only piece of good news in all that is that there were reports that Shannon was pregnant, but they found out after her death in the autopsy that she was not actually pregnant, so only 1 life was taken there instead of 2. You look at those things and say, how can they occur? Do you know? I think I'm beginning to understand it. I got here Wednesday night. I was over there in the Sheraton, and a phone call came from a fellow I've met once. We had 1 brief conversation. He's a juvenile court chaplain over in Nashville, Tennessee, actually for all of Davidson County, Tennessee. For 12 years, he'd been a vice cop. As a matter of fact, for a while, he worked in juvenile vice, and as he says it, "Joe, I went from having those teenagers as all being my enemies to now I'm supposed to take care of them just in 1 job change." He's kind of a neat guy. Teenagers tend to relate to him all right. He's in his early 40s, I guess, but he wears his hair long and got the earring and all those kind of things your preacher would do if he could get away with it. And he goes into these prisons and works with these juveniles, and he said, "You know, I have interviewed every one of the 34 teenage murderers that have been convicted since I have been in this job." He said, "I think I have found that there's some kind of commonality, but I'm not exactly sure what it is." So he began to talk, and I began to ask questions to see if we could help him clarify what it might be, what he had seen, what he'd been discovering and working with these people. He said, "You know, it really is a spiritual war." "Oh man, you don't have to tell me that." That's, by the way, why he called me. He had been reading the books, Seeing the Unseen, I had written about spiritual warfare. And he said, "I just want to talk to you because I think it's a spiritual war." We talked for a while, and he would say something, and I said, "Now, let me clarify what you just said, make sure I'm hearing it right." And he'd say, yeah, that's it. And we talked a little while longer, then you're saying the next thing, and he'd, "Well, yeah, I think that's it." And all the way down to the last point, and it basically became very simple. Interestingly, once the phone call ended, which was rather lengthy, then of course, I just couldn't continue the work I was trying to do of finishing up a new book, and so I turned on the television because I just didn't want to think then for a while. I just wanted to sort of mellow out, and lo and behold, there's Dateline, and what are they doing? Well, they're in Jonesboro, and then toward the end of the program, they started playing clips they had made over the years of juvenile murderers, where they had gone in and interviewed them all the way back to Montana a few years ago, where a fellow walked into his school and shot his teacher and several of his fellow students. Even as recently as over in Pearl, Mississippi, when that young man decided to do away with some of the people after he killed his mother, stabbed her to death, went to school and began to try to execute people. And as I watched them talk to them and listened to the words they said, they were affirming everything I had just heard from this juvenile chaplain, even in the order. You say, well, what is it? Well, it's not going to be some magnificent thing like something you've never thought of. It's just something you put together and say, this makes sense. Without exception, every single one of these people who had committed some terrible crime. Oh, and by the way, if you think this is not relevant to you, hang on. It will be in just a minute. Without single exception, every single one of those people who had committed these heinous crimes have been people who were in tremendous pain of one kind or another. The kind of thing that may have happened to you and you would have shrugged it off, or happened to you and you would have hurt, but you would have made it through, but somehow it hurt them and they couldn't make it past. A mother who left a father and now the family's divorced and the kid lives with this one and not with that one. Or the one in Pearl, Mississippi who said to the reporter, don't you understand, I'm a little overweight and they've made fun of me again and again and again. And the reporter said, hey, there's a lot of people who are overweight and a lot of kids have been made fun of for it. I mean, it doesn't justify killing people. And the kid glowered and said, you don't understand how it hurt. The kid in Montana that shot those folks, talking about the pain that he went through. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, that would always be the precipitator of sin if you think about it. It's something that hurts so badly, but you don't know how to cope with it. You don't know how to deal with it, which leads to the next thing, which becomes even worse. Not just hurt, we've all hurt, but a hurt that leads to a hopelessness. Like there's nothing ahead of my future. There's nothing I can live for, nothing I can look forward to. It'll always be this bad or maybe even worse. Why should I live any longer? But it's not a matter of, oh, well, you keep saying in your churches that there's this heaven afterwards. You keep saying that sometimes death is something we should look forward to. So if this life is so awful and that life is so wonderful, if death is that good, why don't I just die now? But it's not just that simple for them. It's not just let me end one life and start another, because they're mad. They're angry. They're full of this pain. They want to hurt somebody. It used to be that people who were angry wrote suicide notes. My very bright nephew, Dwight Lawson, was helping me understand this yesterday. Those suicide notes, and sometimes the very act of suicide itself, was always designed to hurt people. Let me tell you why this is your fault. Let me do something that makes you feel badly that I've done this. And suicide has very, very seldom been just an act of pure despondency. Suicide is almost always a despondent, hopeless act that's also full of rage and anger. And Dwight said, Have you noticed it's beginning to change? And now it's not just, I'll hurt you by killing me. I'm not writing a note this time. I'm making a statement. I'm going to hurt as many people around me as I can, and there's my note. I'm going to show you how full of rage that I am. Hopelessness. Helplessness. Not thinking you're going to make it, which then leads to an act, which, believe it or not, none of them can believe they did once they did it. Isn't that amazing? After Hastings shot those people, he drank the poison. I mean, you should have seen it. It was on the television. I was not in town to see it, but I saw the replays. They played it in our city for several days, you know? And here the SWAT team, I mean, they had the helmets on, they had the flak jackets on, they had the automatic rifles. They went in a certain kind of pattern. They went into that place looking for Hastings to shoot him down. I mean, you can't blame them. He's in there, he's armed. There's seven people already been shot. They figure he's going to shoot them. They're going to go in and take him out. It's their job. And they went in to take him out. But when they found him, he was already lying on the floor, vomiting from the poison that he had ingested. And now the very people who went in to shoot him decided they would save him so he could spend several millions of dollars to execute him. So they bring him out and they put him in the prison. And Russ Urich, our family minister, is finally allowed to go in and see him. And when Russ, you know, again, I'm not there. Russ gets in to see him, and the first thing Hastings says, after he regains consciousness and Russ can go in, the first thing he says is, I can't believe I did that. That's what the 11-year-old said in Jonesboro. The first thing he said, his granddaddy went to see him. His granddaddy talked on the television. And he said, Granddaddy, I can't talk about it. I can't even remember part of it. Daddy, Granddaddy, I can't believe I did that. Whenever you're interviewing those young killers on the Dateline program, they were all saying the same thing. You see, when a person is full of that kind of hurt, at least of that kind of rage, fueled by that kind of hopelessness, and they go do something, there is absolutely no way they can really understand the consequence of that behavior. Now, I don't know if it's worse for you younger folks or not. I'm not so sure. I begin to wonder if our multimedia world hasn't changed things for you. I mean, you can go watch Scream and see a fellow eviscerated out there on the concrete next to the pool, and you see his guts on that very graphic thing, but you also see him in a movie next week, and he's still alive. You see Drew Barrymore brutally murdered, if you go watch that kind of stuff, but she's on Letterman talking about it. So it's almost like here's the evil, here's the pain, but it doesn't really last because look, here they are. Now you know better than that intellectually, but it's kind of an emotional kind of message. And then of course you get the video games. You shoot them, they come right back. If not, you drop another quarter in and you do it again. It's like we can't even begin to understand the consequence of what it is that we do. I can't believe I did that. You say, man, you're letting these kids have. Oh, it's us too, folks. We old gray hairs are like that, you know? I remember the preacher. His pain was the fact that he had thought that when he married it would be bliss and harmony and wonderful things forever after, not having a comprehension of his wife's hang-ups that she brought into the marriage, and those hang-ups touched many aspects of their life, including, of course, their love life, their sexual life in their marriage. Oh, that would not excuse any kind of sin, obviously not. As a matter of fact, they struggled, they fought, they argued, they cajoled, they cried, they tried to fix it, but it never could. And after a couple of years, when that lady first began to let him know that, you know, she understood his pain and she was there for him, and by this time, after a couple of years of marriage, all that idealism he had carried into it of a wonderful, blissful, happy ever after, right off into the sunset kind of thing, just didn't happen for him anymore. It wasn't there. What was replacing that was his sense of not only rage at not having a marriage be what it was supposed to be, not only pain of having a wife that he somehow couldn't relate to, but hopelessness of, I'm stuck in this for the rest of my life. Now, did he stop and think that through? No. It was just what was inside of him, you see. He didn't yield the first time. He didn't yield the second time. But one day that lady came by and there was just nobody at church but her, and she told him again how she admired him and how she loved him and how she wished she could have been his wife, and how if somehow her husband ever were to die and his wife were to ever die, surely God meant for these two people to be together, something he had already been thinking about for a while. And by the way, if you married folks are thinking like that, you're already in a mess. Didn't mean for it to happen. Fumbled with buttons and zippers, and in just a few minutes, he said, all I could think was, I can't believe I did that. How could you do that? And then wishing that you'd wake up, that it didn't happen. You just dreamed it. It wasn't really part of your life. That somehow it would go away. That it didn't. But it did. And I think that as I have watched Satan work his, what's the word? His trade, his system, his plan. I almost called it his magic, because in a way it almost is like magic, you know? But it's not magic. I don't believe in that stuff. All he has to do is look around and find where you're hurting. And I'll guarantee you how he doesn't have to look far in this house at all, does he? I mean, some of you were abused as children, sexually or physically or mentally, by your parents or by some other relative, and you carry scars inside of you people can't even begin to understand, and it just hurts. Some of you have been abused after you became an adult because you decided to go into the ministry thinking that people would say, you're a minister, praise God, boy, we'll love and take care of you, and discovered that some people view ministers like that and others view them as targets. Prey. People to be beaten and destroyed. Some of you have been part of churches that have been ruled by theotrophies, who all they can do or think about doing is controlling and manipulating and making people feel as guilty and rotten as possible. I mean, I don't know where the hurt is. Some of you have been bankrupt, or some of you are going bankrupt right now. Some of you have seen your teenage children, the ones that you had put all your hope and heart into, raising them with all your love, thinking they were going to be the greatest things on earth. And here they are doing things you never thought they'd do, going places you never thought they'd go, saying things you never thought they'd say. And you're thinking, of course, like any parent would think, what did I do? I mean, how far do you go? You think these teenagers don't hurt? Man, if you ever put them in an environment where they could tell you without having to posture, you'd hear tales of woe and pain. And the anger comes. My brothers and sisters, I don't know why, but it seems that somehow we have sort of shifted Christianity around. Not all of us, not all of our churches, not all of our people, but enough of us have somehow shifted Christianity around that for the people in pain we offer no hope at all. No hope at all. None. We tell a preacher's wife who says, our relationship is awful, something needs to be done, I can't handle it anymore. And actually, church leaders sometimes say, you just got to put up with it and live with it and be quiet, otherwise you'll ruin his ministry, so just suffer in silence. Like that somehow is going to make it better. And what you've now done is put that person in a sense of total hopelessness. There is no hope for the future. It's always going to be that way. Somebody molested you? Big hairy deal. Get over it. Oh, there's no hope, huh? Never for me. That's what we tell them. And it goes on and on. And finally, people wind up doing these things they can't believe they do. And I know it's not all of our churches. And I know it's not all of our people. But when they finally do that thing they can't believe that they did, they can't tell anybody. They can't come and say, ah, I don't know how, I don't know why, but I did it. And I need deliverance. Because at least with some of our churches and some of our Christians, if they were to tell you that heinous thing they themselves couldn't believe, you would not heal, you would not deliver, you would castigate and ostracize. And so they try to hide it, which leads to more pain, more hopelessness, and more of the same act they couldn't believe they did to begin with. Why would they go back and do it twice? Because there's no other place to look for healing. And at least that offered some counterfeit system that appeared to be healing for a while. And so our kids. I mean, I'm old enough to call you a kid, okay? They start getting their own perverted system of what's right and wrong. Oh, we've decided intercourse is wrong. We'll go into our marriage a virgin. But oral sex is okay because oral sex is not a sin. I've heard that from the highest levels of our government. Or it's okay to lie if you love somebody and you're running trying to help them out. Because lying's okay then, don't you understand? Or it's okay to cheat if it's helping out somebody who didn't have time to do the homework. Because don't you know, they really got a sort of busy life and things are miserable. So, yeah, I did the homework for them. But it's not sin because you don't understand the situation. And it's the same kind of thing we adults are doing. And nobody can tell. Nobody can talk. Nobody can walk up and say, let me, because you know why? Society looks down on you. How could you possibly do that kind of thing? And if you ever tell anybody, how could you be so weak? And much less can we mourn it. We have to put on our smiley face and come to church and pretend we're as holy as the rest of the bunch. So we're pretending they're as holy as us. We started with a passage a couple of days ago for those of you who were in that class that said that God is with those who are lowly and contrite in spirit. That means, first of all, my brothers and sisters, that we have to come face to face with our sin. And I told you yesterday, and I'm going to just make sure you hear it again today, that when you finally can come face to face with your sin, it's going to hurt you, whatever the sin is. But you see, when you come face to face with your sin, it's not a continuation of hopelessness. It's not even a continuation of pain. It will hurt, but you finally are making the first measurement toward fixing the pain. It's like going for the surgery rather than putting it off and putting it off and putting it off. It's like it's going to hurt, but at least now it can fix it. And I do realize, of course, that some of us have done church. in such a way that if anybody shows any emotion over their sin, we ridicule them. Don't want any emotionalism in this church. I got to do it. Forgive me. I mean, if it's wrong, God have mercy on my soul, but I got to do it. Picked this up here yesterday at the workshop. This writer, this fellow who claims not only to be a Christian but a guide to the rest of us, starts referencing a story told by Larry West of a revival where he was, and a man who had come finally face to face with his own sinfulness just literally physically fell apart. Shivering, shaking, barely able to talk. If you've ever been in any situation where a person finally comes face to face with his sin and at the same time face to face with God, you have seen it. If it's ever been you that finally came face to face with your sin and face to face with God, you have experienced it. He tells part of this, talking about the brother breaking down, weeping so hard he could make no audible, intelligible sounds, unutterable groanings, ! Finally, between his choking, having difficulty in breathing, swallowing, or speaking, he was able with great effort to blurt out. And then he makes fun. He makes fun of the man confessing his sin because he didn't think the sin was big enough to worry about like that. Listen to this direct quote, my brothers and sisters. Boo, hoo, hoo. Isn't that terrible? Use this phrase, sobbing, slobbering, sentimental. And then uses the phrase, people who are baptized while swimming in a sea of tears do not remain faithful to the church overnight. Then he says, all this blubbering is a colossal waste. Oh, he has to give you a scripture for that. It's in 1 Corinthians 16:13. Watch ye, stand fast in the faith, quit ye like men, be strong. Did you hear what he said? If you're a man, you don't hurt. If you're a man, you don't cry. If you're a man, you never tell people that rotten stuff you did. That's right, my brothers. If you're a man, you hide it and you keep on doing it. That's what he's implying, isn't he? Quit, be strong. I'll tell you what. It was that same Paul that wrote, be strong and be a man, who said that he preached with tears. That same Paul. Did you know that? Have you ever read that story in Luke chapter 7 of that woman who comes to the dinner party, gets at Jesus' feet and sobs so much that she washes her feet with the tears? He said, of course, that was a woman. They can cry, they can be emotional, not men. Well, just back up two chapters, dude. There you got the Apostle Peter who's out fishing with the Lord. Can you imagine trying to compete with him in a bass tournament? He's out fishing with the Lord, and they bring in a hole. And what does Peter do when he finally realizes that it's God? That this is not just a good preacher. He's God. He comes face to face with his own sin. What does he do? He can't even stand up and look him in an eye. What does he do? He falls at his knees. Why? Because when you finally realize your own sinfulness and the goodness and greatness of God, you can't look him in the eye. You can't stand up. It's emotional for a person to collapse. I'll bet you Peter was emotional, don't you? And when he said, Lord, go away. That's pretty emotional, don't you think? To tell God to leave? Lord, go away. Why? I'm a sinful man. My brothers and sisters, if you want the healing of God for the pain that's in your heart that leads to the rage and hopelessness that you have and has led, is leading, or will lead you to do those things you cannot believe that you did, that you can't even begin to, before the act, understand the consequences of, then the healing first starts with your brokenness before God. And yes, that probably will make you cry. And yes, it may make you do something extremely emotional. And so if you have even some people who claim to be Christians who are telling you that sin, there's only one thing to do with this stuff, and it's throw it in the fireplace because it's wrong. Don't you have to wonder, David, what guilt this man is dealing with that makes him act like that? It's the guilt that God would heal. He said, it just crying? No, no, no. I'm not even saying, I can't give you, okay, here's the five steps. Believe, repent, cry, confess. I'm not telling you that. I'm saying it comes down to facing your sinfulness, which makes you look at God and say, okay, so they hurt me, but I've done sinful things too. Okay, they really hurt me bad, but I've done sinful things too. And it is not hopeless, because God, I know You are the healer of everything. I know that You can do everything. I know that You can take a life that is miserable and messed up and just awful, and You can make it into a life that's fulfilled and meaningful. I know You can take a man like the Apostle Paul, who breathes out slaughter toward the church and tries his best to kill Christians, and make him the most famous apostle of all. I know You take a man like Peter, who was just a man who babbled a lot. That's what he says. That one day he's saying, I can do this. The next day he's saying, I can do that. Have you ever met that guy? Have you ever been that guy? Lord, if they try to kill you, oh, here they come. You know Peter. And make him into the rock that we still read the teachings of and learn from today, then I'll guarantee you that even if somebody abused you as a child, or even if you abused somebody who was a child, even if your spouse left you and committed because he or she committed adultery and ran away, or even if you were the one who committed adultery, if your mama and daddy totally let you down, or if your children destroyed your entire family, that whatever it is that has occurred, whatever the pain is, God, with His great healing power, can take it away. There is a balm in Gilead. Amen. But He'll heal the sin sick soul. So admit your sin. You say, is that easy? No. No, there are a couple of things that have to happen after that. When you confess your sin to God, and oh, by the way, I look forward to the time when we can do it in any church, anywhere, stand up and tell it. Oh, I've seen it a time or two. I was speaking up in, I won't tell you the city. I was speaking in a city a long way from here. Most everywhere I go is a long way from here, actually. And preaching on sin. You say, why? Because I'm a sinner. That's why I preach on sin. I'm the only guy I know that can talk about sin graphically without people thinking, what's he doing? Because they all know I'm doing it anyway. I mean, I've done it. Not doing it, but done it. And so here it is. And this guy, one of the elders in the church, revered, respected, a shepherd. We know that elders don't sin, right? This guy comes to the front, and rather than filling out a card that the preacher could take and then water down to tell the church. Really? Or rather than saying, if I have, he asked for the microphone, and he stood up, and his elder took the microphone and addressed his church on a Sunday morning. And he said, I need you to help me. I need you to pray for me. I am addicted to pornography. Well, they de-eldered him, didn't they? No. Ah, they made him quit teaching a Bible class, didn't they? No, they didn't let him wait on the Lord's table, did they? Well, yeah, they did. They didn't punish him? Now, he was already pretty well punished, don't you think? They just wanted to deliver him. What do you think happens in the church when an elder can send him confess his sin? What do you think happens to those other sinners out there? But the first thing that has to happen is, if you're going to have revival, by the way, in your churches, is your leaders better start confessing the real sins they have. But once we confess that sin before God in brokenness, by the way, do you think he was emotional? Do you think the church was emotional? Was it bad? It was healing. Then the next thing you got to believe is this, and this is the most crucial thing. I told you yesterday, forgive themselves, you cannot forgive yourself. You are not in a forgiving yourself business. It's not your job. God forgives you. But if God forgives you, then you must believe what God tells you about you. Do what? Real quick, I don't have time to even read it. Not time here. You've got to get out of Jeff's way. But in Romans chapter 6, you can read it. Here's what it says. It first talks about those of us who've been baptized, okay? And then it says, don't you know? That's what he's saying. Don't you know that all of us were baptized into Jesus Christ? And then he says that when that happened, that the body of sin was rendered powerless because the old man was crucified. Now, I'm translating from the NIV and using the footnote. Because here's what happens. There's a part of me that is called the flesh, the sarx. The NIV calls it the sinful nature. It's the part of me that is still susceptible to sin. Have you won? There's another part of me called the old man. These two things are not the same thing. He's saying, here's what happens. When you come to God for God's cleansing power, God crucifies the old man. You mean God crucifies the part of me that wants to sin? No. God crucifies what you were. The old man. What does that do to the part of me that wants to sin? If I understand and accept that the part of me that has done it has been crucified, the old man, if I can accept the fact that it's over, it's past, it's done, it's gone, if I can accept that, then my flesh doesn't have near the power over me that it had. Why? Because the pain's being removed. Why? Because of the hopelessness is being removed. Why? It's because I'm now seeing myself in a totally different light. That's what happened in the past. That's not what I am. That's what I did. What am I? I am a new man in Christ. But look at what you did. I don't want to. I've been there. I lived through that. I don't want to go back over there. You say, but wait a minute, Joe. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Sometimes you talk about your past. I tell you what, sometimes I do, but I don't do it for me, because if it were up to me, I'd never talk about it again as long as I live. You say, why do you do it sometimes? Because I was commanded to in 2 Corinthians 1:1. It says you comfort others with the comfort with which you have been comforted. But you see, it's not me hanging on to my past because I still feel guilty. Then when I talk about the past, it's because I'm celebrating the victory of God. There's a total different thing there. I think that all of us who have been through some kind of mess, and that pretty near covers most of us, if all of us who've been through some kind of mess, once we accept God's healing, can talk about the healing of that mess, we'll help other people get healed. But those who keep talking about, let me tell you what I am, let me tell you what I am, I'll tell you what you are. You're a Christian that doesn't believe God. Do what? I was a young preacher, LaGrange, Georgia. I hadn't even finished college yet. Moved over there because they couldn't afford any better and I needed some money. Little church, you know, little 125 folks. Dwight remembers LaGrange. Well, that's okay. I went over there, and I'm their young preacher, you know, and I'll never forget. I'd been there like a year or two. One of the deacons called and said, I'm coming to see you. Scared me to death. If he just dropped in, it'd have been better, you know. When you're 22 years old, haven't even finished your Bible degree yet, and somebody's coming for help, and he's 30 years old. He walked in, he sat down and said, well, I got a problem. I aim for you to fix it. I said, why me? He said, we pay you, boy. What's your problem? He said, something I did 15 years ago that I just can't get over. I still feel guilty about it every day of my life. I'm thinking, I bet he killed somebody. Or at least he had adultery. I mean, fornications. I mean, it had to be something bad. I said, what'd you do? He said, when I was stationed in the army in Germany 15 years ago, I didn't go to church like I should. And? And what, boy? And what'd you do when you didn't go to church? Well, I went fishing. But what is it you feel so guilty about? He said, are you deaf? I told you I feel guilty because I didn't go to church like I should. And I'm thinking there's got to be more to it. He's hiding. It's got to be something bad. I'm 22. I understand these things. And so I start digging and finally couldn't realize it really is. And then that's when it finally began to dawn on me. It doesn't have to be the biggest sin in the world for a person to be eaten up with guilt about it and torn up about it. For them, it is the biggest sin in the world. And so I'm listening to him and I finally said, okay, have you asked God to forgive you every day of my life for 15 years? Have you repented? Absolutely. Well, you come to church now, don't you? Yeah, don't want to, but I'm here most of the time. I know he's at church. He was the guy snoring on the third row most every Sunday. I see him. And he said, fix it. Oh, God, if you will, please. Give this young, innocent idiot some kind of wisdom to answer that older idiot. I would appreciate this very, very much. Because at that time, you see, I still didn't understand the pain. He wasn't an idiot. He was hurting. Finally, I said, Bobby, you got two sons, right? Jeff and Mark, uh-huh. One of them was like 8, I think, okay? And I said, the ages get blurred after a while. I said, suppose you tell Jeff, your 18-year-old, that when you go to work tomorrow, you want him to feed those hunting dogs you got out back. When you come back home tomorrow afternoon, he works in Atlanta. He drives 65 miles up to Atlanta and drive back to LaGrange. I said, you get home tomorrow afternoon, the kids are all out playing football in that big old front yard of yours, and you know a lot about dogs. You look at your dogs, and they're kind of whimpering out there, and you finally realize they haven't been fed. Jeff! Yeah, Daddy? You feed them dogs? Oh, Daddy. Man, I meant to, but I forgot. I'm sorry, Daddy. I did wrong. Okay, son, you did wrong, but go feed the dogs. He feeds the dogs. Next day you come home, and there's Jeff. All the other kids are again playing football under the big old trees in the front yard. Not Jeff. He's sitting over there under a tree just moping. What's the matter, boy? Daddy, I feel so bad about them dogs. Son, it's all right. I told you I forgave you. I mean, it was a bad thing, but I forgave you. Okay. Now, you come home 4 or 5 weeks later. All the other kids are all playing. Not Jeff. He's on the steps. What's the matter, son? You sick? No, Daddy. Thinking about them dogs. Son, it was bad, but it's over. Okay, Bobby's 18 years. He's 8 years old now. Let's go 10 years into the future. He is 18. He graduates from high school. You're on the front row looking at him, happy that he's finally getting out of school. He goes across the stage, gets his diploma, looks at you and says, Daddy, sorry about them dogs. Let's put him a little further. He's now 23. He's off in college. Maybe he's already married. Maybe he got a grandkid by now. That's 15 years from now, Bobby. 15 years. He comes home for Thanksgiving. You can't wait to see him and that new grandbaby. And he walks in the door and says, Daddy, remember them dogs 15 years ago? Well, can you forgive me? I said, Bobby, what would you think if Jeff did that? He'd say, I think he didn't believe his daddy. Ooh, yeah. You tell the truth, Bobby? Yes, sir. Do you tell Jeff he's forgiven? Yes, sir. If he doesn't believe it, then you think he doesn't believe you, right? Yes, sir. Well, just look at it with you. What has God said? I put your sin as far away from you as the east is from the west. Now, just how far is that? Can you measure it? I'll make you so clean it's like you're a new baby starting over. I mean, you ever want to be there? I'll never remember your sin anymore. That doesn't mean that God can forget. It just means that God's never bringing it up again, ever again, ever. Then why do you want to keep reminding of something he didn't want to think about? It would only be if you don't believe him. Maybe the thing we should be praying for, my brother and sister, to get past the guilt that we feel is to go back and first deal with that pain of our sinfulness and confess it to Christian people. Oh, by the way, that kid in Montana that shot his teacher and those other folks talked about how his pain. He said something that just absolutely fascinated me. He broke down and cried about his crime, and then the reporter asked, what would you tell to all the teenagers in America? He said, I tell them, if you hurt, tell somebody. And if he can't help you, tell somebody else. And if they can't help you, tell somebody else. But keep telling, because there's somebody who will love you and help you, and then you won't be here. To every teenager in this audience, whatever age you are, if you hurt, you preachers, you elders, you handsome young folk, tell somebody. If you got the guts, tell your church. Yes, some will castigate you and some will make fun of you. Some will hold it against you for the rest of their lives. But that is their spiritual problem, not yours. When you tell somebody, you will find that there are more people out there who understand and will wrap you up in the love of Jesus and reassure you of God's saving grace, so that then you can start believing that God tells you the truth when he says, I hate you did it, but it's done. I hate you did it, but it's over. I'm going to forget about it. I told you that. I promised you I'm going to forget about it. Now, will you? And let God heal your heart. But you got to believe it. You got to believe it. I want to offer you a challenge, and then I'm going to say a prayer, and we're done. What's the challenge, Joe? Tell it today. If you're in love with your neighbor that you're not married to, if you're sneaking off and getting drunk, if you're hiding out in some car with some guy or some girl, if you're stealing money, if you're lying, if find a godly, mature Christian today and start telling them about it. But I might cry. It's okay. I might even fall down. It's okay. They might not help me. Tell somebody else. They may not. Tell somebody else. And tomorrow, if you're at home, tell your church. It's where healing comes. If with that you can believe God. Will you take that challenge? Oh God, somehow I just really feel like I have failed you today. That you had a message and that somehow it got muddled through the messenger. So God, I just ask you right now, if you will, just to reach into every heart of the thousands of people in this audience right now and somehow take what has been shared and take the scriptures they already know and the Bible studies they've been through and the awareness of you that they already have. And God, take all that knowledge and just pierce the heart with it. God, I ask you specifically for two things for every person in this audience. I ask you, first of all, that you give them the courage to confess, no matter what some brother or sister may do in ludicrous response. To confess, to find the healing. And God, I ask that you not let them be afraid of their emotions when they come face to face with you in their sinfulness. And God, I ask for you this for everybody in this building, including me. Give us the faith. Give us the faith to believe that you tell the truth. Please, God, give us the faith to believe that. Through Jesus. Amen.